The next matter is Osborne versus REI.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Mark Davis on behalf of the appellant, Mr. James Osborne. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Very well.
Unless there's any preliminary questions from the Court, there are 3 issues I would like to touch on today. The issue of the undue burden defense, the instructions and verdict form on the accommodation claim, and the wrongful termination claims. As to undue burden, this is the...
Well, I didn't think we got there. I thought there was a stipulation there wasn't going to be a trial on that.
On undue burden?
Yeah.
That is not correct. The defense was never pled or raised by the defendant, but as a matter of fact and what evidence and argument was presented at trial, it was pursued. And that was precisely the problem, is that the trial court refused to give a jury instruction on the defense of undue burden. And that is reversible error under Easley versus Sealand, where extensively throughout the trial, argument and evidence was presented that accommodating Mr. Osborne would impose an undue burden upon REI. And that's problematic because the undue burden, the aspect of undue burden, is actually REI's affirmative burden to carry. And without that instruction, the jury had no way to understand that. And that's what Easley says. Easley says without that instruction, it's easy for the jury to go ahead and put that burden onto Mr. Osborne. So not only does he have to prove that his accommodation is reasonable, but then he has to take the additional step of disproving or proving that it's not an undue burden on REI, and that is contrary to the law. That is.
So which proposed instruction did you give to the court that would address this? What was the number?
Ours was a modified version of WPI 33034.
Yeah, but which number was it?
Our proposed number was number 11, and you can find that at CP 3247 to 3248. And so that instruction was critical to inform the jury of that distinction between reasonableness and undue burden, and that because you can have a scenario.
So did you make it clear to Judge O'Donnell that he needed to give that instruction for the reasons you're arguing today?
Yes.
All right.
I think we did that at several points in time. We filed a motion in limine to preclude the vehicle for the undue burden defense, which was arguing layoffs, and he denied our motion in that regard. Once that occurred, as part of our proposed instructions, we included an undue burden defense.
Why are layoffs an undue burden defense?
So that was the way at trial in which the defense manifested itself. REI claimed that it was going through a series of layoffs, and so to keep Mr. Osborne's job, which was the accommodation, would impose an undue burden on the company. And so they argued that they had soft sales. They argued that they had to cut
costs.
You're
arguing the evidence, and time is short. There's a lot of dispute in the briefs about jury instruction 7.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, you objected to the last sentence of that instruction.
I think we objected to the last two paragraphs of it for a number of...
I think you objected only to the last paragraph, but... I'll look at the record if you say you objected to both. What was the basis for your objection?
Well, it just as an initial matter, it's I think it's a double negative. It reads poorly. It's hard to understand. The biggest.
Did you say that? Did you point that out to the court below?
Yes. I noted this in the briefing. Even opposing counsel called it an appeal bond.
I know that.
Because it was so awkward and it didn't follow the law. The biggest problem from our perspective is it was contrary to Barnett. It actually said that Mr. Osborne was not entitled to a preference. It then attached any accommodation only if they found the job was the purpose of an accommodation. And that's contrary to cases like Curtis and Dean that say even if the reason you're losing your job has nothing to do with your disability, there still is an interactive process that needs to occur. There's still an affirmative obligation by the employer to reach out and take certain steps to help accommodate the employee. So in the trial court's jury instruction number 7, he's actually saying the opposite, that the only time they have any obligation is if the job is the accommodation. And while that was true, that statement of law is not correct, either under Curtis or under Dean or under Barnett. I can see that I'm short on time, so unless
what about the wrongful discharge summary judgment issue that you raise? I think one of the questions is whether the evidence that you submitted from Halverson is inadmissible hearsay.
From Ms. Halverson's declaration?
Yes.
I don't know if we briefed that in detail. I would contest that it was hearsay. It was her own personal knowledge based on what she heard and perceived.
But she's repeating what somebody else said.
Well, I think she was, I don't know that she quoted it verbatim. She quoted her understanding of what had happened, as well as what she had communicated to others, that the statements about Mr. Osborne would have been offensive. I think beyond that, I think that there's other evidence that's in the record and was admitted at summary judgment that clearly militates against summary judgment.
And what would that evidence be?
So, for instance, there was
talking about summary judgment, not the trial.
Yes, now we're backing up to summary judgment, which Judge Cahan presided over. The prima facie elements largely were not in dispute. The issue boiled down to one of causation, which is typically an issue of fact.
Well, you still have to put forth evidence. So what was your evidence?
Certainly. So, for instance, we had evidence of disparate treatment as compared to colleagues. There were two other IT employees who were let go, I believe, about 2 months before Mr. Osborne. Both received significantly better treatment than him. You can see that memorialized, I believe it's CP 925. There's an email that's sent out to the entire department letting them know that these two employees received significant advance notice, the opportunity to continue working, and affirmative actions from the company to help them find new jobs, which stands in stark contrast to the treatment Mr. Osborne received, where he was brought into a meeting that was initially intended to discuss his workload. That gets repurposed into his termination meeting. He receives no notice. They don't work with him to find any other job, and they lead him to the car to the same day. That's really strong evidence of disparate treatment, in addition to the temporal proximity. But I can see that I'm out of time, so I'd like to reserve my rebuttal time.
You have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. James Sanders for Respondent REI. May it please the Court. There are three orders that are at issue here. It's a jury verdict in favor of REI on the reasonable accommodation claim, and there are two summary judgment orders on a disparate treatment theory for disability discrimination and wrongful termination in violation of public policy. I'm going to start with the reasonable accommodation claim and then move to the other two.
Well, I think you need to address the jury instruction. The question is, if it was an erroneous jury instruction, I'm talking about number 7, and I don't mean to preclude you from talking about the undue burden because we've heard about that and you do need to address it. But as to jury instruction 7, assume it's erroneous. Has Mr. Osborne shown prejudice?
No, he hasn't.
And why not?
Well, we believe the error in the jury instruction is it says that a jury can't.
Well, you disagree about what the error is, and I think that in some ways it's irrelevant, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, the reason Mr. Osborne was not prejudiced is the jury instruction actually favored his position. It allowed him to argue to the jury in closing and throughout the trial that, in fact, REI did have a duty when it was making a layoff decision to treat him not equal to other employees.
And that was a clever way of pointing out what your dispute is with Instruction 7, too.
I do think that's a clever way of pointing out how what our dispute is with Instruction 7. We think that the correct statement of the law is that an employee who is successfully accommodated in their job, when there are economic forces that are requiring that layoffs be done, that employee is already on an equal playing field. The idea of the affirmative duty of reasonable accommodation is not to give disabled employees better treatment than everybody else. It's to bring them up to equal so that when decisions are made, like reductions in force, hiring, firing, all these different decisions, that the question is the same as for everybody else. Are you treated fairly? Are you treated without discrimination?
Well, there are cases. I mean, Dean and Curtis do talk about affirmative steps, but I understand that's not in the layoff.
Right. It's in the circumstance where the current position cannot be accommodated.
So you, in the circumstance where the current position cannot be accommodated.
Sure. Dean, here's where Dean works, and a number of courts have recognized this factor. You look for other jobs for an employee who is working with a disability when they can't be accommodated in their current job, or right, when their current accommodations aren't working anymore. That's when you look around to find different jobs.
Well, here, you were laying him off, so he could no longer work 28 hours as a consultant. Okay. So why wasn't there some sort of obligation to assist him in identifying other jobs that would be available in the REI Corporation?
Okay, well, two parts of the answer. One, the reason there's not an affirmative duty is because there's not an affirmative duty for everybody else, right? The treatment in the layoff situation when you're making these decisions is to treat everybody the same, not to treat some employees better. I mean, there's going to be a lot of employees that are working with accommodations. I think I used the stand-up desk example in the brief. There are many examples that are like that. They don't get treated better or different when you're doing layoffs. They get treated equal. You don't tell them months in advance, as Mr. Osborne asked here.
So is there a case or cases that you're specifically relying on that are analogous for the layoff situation?
Aponte versus Diaz is probably the closest.
Is that the closest?
It's a federal district court. So it's basically this situation. Somebody's laid off. And they say, which is, this actually touches on the undue burden argument too, that the idea is when I'm being laid off, if I'm an employee working with a disability, I get all of the other extra bumps that I would get in other circumstances. I get told first. I get first dibs at open positions. I get treated better than all the other employees that are being treated.
So what about the undue burden argument? That was the lead argument here today.
Well, the undue burden argument is a standard instruction, and it should be given when an employee proposes a reasonable accommodation and an employer refuses to give it. Those are the two leading cases. We've cited them in our brief that talk about this approach. Both involved that circumstance. You had an employee who asked for an accommodation. In the one case, it was a worker in a factory who
asked. So what case are we talking about?
Well, I get the name right off the top of my head, John. I can get it real quick. But they're both Washington cases.
Okay.
And
they're both lead cases.
They're both cases where undue burden was not given, and it was found to be reversible error. And in both of those cases, the facts were that the employee had asked for a particular accommodation. In one instance, they'd asked to be moved from heavy duty to medium duty, and there were medium duty jobs available. And the employer said, we can't do this. In the other circumstance, the employee asked to be relieved from a 50-pound lifting requirement, and the employer said, we can't do this. In those circumstances, undue burden has to be given. But in a circumstance like this, where that never happened, there's 4.5 years of REI accommodating Mr. Osborne, and for those 4.5 years, REI wasn't close to the line of what the law required. It was beyond the line at every step of the way. The only time REI ever said no, ever, to Mr. Osborne was when he asked for a guarantee of a job until he retired, and they just said, we can't do that. And that's the only time they ever said no to him. And in fact, the theory that he's proposing in this case is that's what he was entitled to, that the disability law says that you can't ever lay off a disabled employee unless you could show that it was an undue burden.
I think that overstates. I mean, I do think they're saying that you can't unless you engage in the interactive process and you take affirmative steps.
Well, and that will go to the second part of this response, Your Honor, is that, in fact, REI did those things, as just another example of the many times that it went beyond the law.
Well, at what point in time? I mean, they're focused on at the point of what they call termination, not layoff. I mean, you had two very different theories here.
Here's the facts, and these are not undisputed in terms of how this process went forward. Mr. Osborne was working on a particular project,
right,
PCI audit. That project ended at the end of November. Right? His job for the 4 years he was at REI was to do different projects on an as-needed basis.
Right.
He would move around to do different things.
And he'd successfully done this audit, and so then they decided, we're going to make this into a full-time job. We're going to lay you off because we're laying, I don't know, we're going to lay you off, and you're not qualified for this new job that we're creating.
Well, but there was more to it than that, Your Honor. The evidence was not just that about this particular job. The evidence was also that before Mr. Osborne was told he was laid off, after this new job was approved, and it's not disputed he was not qualified to perform this job, after this new job was approved, Ed Telders, his manager, who, by the way, was also laid off in the same round of layoffs as Mr. Osborne, his manager went to every other director in the IT department and said, do we have any more projects that Jim can do?
Is that, this is Mr. Telders, who's large in the record. So did he testify to that at trial?
At trial and also in his deposition, which was before the judge on summary judgment. So and there was multiple testimony about this. There were the search was made for jobs in late November before the decision was made to lay off Mr. Osborne. Now, it's not surprising, particularly in hindsight, that there were no positions available. I mean, this was REI was getting their numbers for the holiday in late November, early December. They were below target. Mr. Osborne says this himself. It's in an email that he sent using an alias to the Seattle Times. Sales 2% under targets, layoffs 100 people spread out over several months.
On the retaliatory discharge claim, he settles his personal injury cause of action in late August. He's terminated less than 4 months later. Subsequent to his termination, the chief legal officer makes fun of him or mocks his causes of action at an employee gathering. Why doesn't that state a prima facie case and what he needs to show pretext in order to get to a jury on retaliatory discharge?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Your Honor. I wanted to have a chance to address that before I was done. So, first of all, the timing is not correct. The bike lawsuit settled on August 1st. It's not disputed. That's actually in the complaint. It's CP3. We answered it, CP20, admitting it settled on August 1st. The decision to lay him off is made late November, about 4 months later, by an entirely different set of people. Okay, Mr. Osborne worked in the IT department. The IT department, his managers, people that worked with him, had nothing to do with the bicycle lawsuit. That was a product suit, involved manufacturers from overseas. It was largely run by insurance defense from the insurance company. So none of the same people were involved. And in fact, REI took affirmative steps to make sure that people stayed away from it. Nobody was informed about the progress of the suit. Nobody in the business was told what was going on. There's no evidence at all in the record that anybody involved in the steps that led to Mr. Osborne's termination. There were multiple steps and multiple people involved. Mr. Melvin pushed for creating this new position. That took away a task Mr. Osborne might have been able to do. His boss, Ed Telders, and all the other IT directors looked for other things for him to do. Kristen Bradley looked for open positions before she had the layoff meeting. And none of those people were involved. So there was zero evidence that there's any connection between those two things. It's simply a blind inference. Okay. Unless Your Honor have any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I think there's one issue that needs to be reemphasized, which is the IT consultant position was the accommodation, and it was working well. So the issue is not whether there were jobs and whether there are layoffs. The issue is, why isn't that accommodation reasonable anymore? And what I consistently hear at trial and hear today is that it's an undue burden for them to keep the position open, which means the instruction should have been given, because that's the reason they're saying, we can't keep your accommodation anymore. We can't keep doing this. It's too expensive. You don't add enough value. So we're eliminating your accommodation. And when you do that, you have an affirmative obligation under the law to engage that person. And that's always been the question in this case that REI has never been able to answer with an honest, straight face, which is, why not just talk to him?
So what case or cases are you relying on? We've heard from counsel representing REI, but what cases are you relying on that are analogous for your argument related to undue burden?
To undue burden? I think it's squarely under Easley and Irwin out of Division III. And I would speak to that. one point that's key, in addition to the financial arguments and the cost arguments and the sales arguments, is that they argued Mr. Osborne did not add value. And there's specifically a WAC that implements RCW 4960 that says those arguments and those factors are undue burden. Those are things that the jury should consider when addressing that issue. And the specific site is WAC 162.22.080 subsection 3. And so, again, not only are they making the argument about you're too expensive, but they're also saying you don't add enough value. That's undue burden.
If someone's accommodated by working at a stand-up desk, is the accommodation their job or the stand-up desk?
Well, that's obviously apples to oranges. The desk is a desk. It's not the job. That is, you know, akin to
so
giving.
Where at what point, what if the person can only work 6 hours a day at a stand-up desk?
Okay.
Is it the job or is it a stand-up desk plus only 6 hours?
Well, I think that's you would have to know what they were doing.
You know where I'm heading here is where do we go from furniture to being the accommodation to the actual job itself being the accommodation? Where does that change?
And I'm not sure that I think the slippery slope argument applies here because REI's own top HR folks admitted that the job was the accommodation. And we've never disputed that.
Yeah, but this is your case, and it's important to you. What we do here is decide your case, wary of the cases that come along after you, when you're long gone and we're still holding that bag that you left us with. So where does it morph from furniture to job?
Well, again, and I think in this case, there's a clear agreement from both sides that the job is the accommodation, and in this case, it's the aspects of the job. In terms of flexible schedule, no deadlines, he can move from project to project. It's a brand new job. They created it out of nowhere. You would have a very different scenario if he had been given data entry position one, and then he tried to argue that that's an accommodation. That wouldn't be the case. So I would concede that in this case, it's unique in the sense of what accommodation was provided, but we still fall under the line of cases in terms of Curtis and Dean that impose the affirmative obligation on REI to interact with Mr. Osborne when they take that accommodation away. And it's undisputed that that's what happened. In